All right, make sure you're in fellowship as we continue on here. Genesis 44, verses 1 through 5. We see that sometime after the feast, when Joseph's brothers were all inebriated, Joseph gives orders to his house steward to bring about his ultimate scheme, deception, and that is putting the silver cup, his drinking cup, in the sack of Benjamin, in which he will then make accusation that the cup was stolen in this way. And the reason why Benjamin is targeted, obviously, it's more complex than just one reason, i.e. his blood brother. He is the only brother that has not ever done any harm. But he also knows that the affection that his father has for Benjamin, based on previous conversations in their earlier trip in regards to Benjamin, his protective nature and things of this nature. And he is trying to put the brothers in a real bind to return back home without Benjamin. First time they had to go without Simeon, and now let him try to explain to their father about Benjamin. So he tested their attitude towards Benjamin earlier at the feast, as we dealt with, to see if there was any jealousy when he extended the larger portions to Benjamin and food, etc., over the brothers. But this didn't really tell him what he was wanting to know, ultimately, and that is, are they still nurturing hatred and exercising it towards Benjamin as replacement of Joseph's loss within the family household? Or have they grown spiritually? Got a handle in regards to their animosity, allowing love, unity, doctrine to have a positive effect in their lives, overruling their sin natures in that respect. And it is this concept, their attitude, that Joseph will come to grips with, that both fuels his, continues to fuel his revenge to a certain extent, but ultimately the positive outcome of it will neutralize it, and he'll pull his horns in, as we know, and will ultimately reveal himself to his brothers. So, point 24, page 4 of our notes, the concept of thought will either extinguish Joseph's STA revenge pursuit or further fuel it. 25, it appears that his plan here is to keep Benjamin with him if he sees a continued negative side to his brothers, and send them home once again to face their father under that circumstance. 26, they had to explain the absence of Simeon the first time. Now let them explain Benjamin's. So to put them in a real bind, put their underwear in a bunch, in a twist, if you will. He's really trying to bring it about in regards to their situation and lives, to bring misery and turmoil, confusion, all the things that he experienced when he was kidnapped and sold off in slavery himself. And he's trying to recreate that through his own deception, his own devious plans here in this respect. So 27, now while Joseph's orders here to the house steward of filling their bags with grain to the bin, to the brim, to put the money back in their sacks again. So while Joseph's orders can be speculative as to sub-motives, that is, as I mentioned, make sure the families have plenty of food, that seemed to be his one, at least an underlying intent in the first time around, to make sure that the family was fed, hence why he changed his mind and only keeping one brother rather than keeping them all incarcerated, because he knew Jacob and the rest of the family was in need of food. extended grace with the refunds. Again, the first time around, you couldn't really pinpoint that there was any exceptional hostility attached to giving the money back. It seemed more of a grace approach, what it might do to the brothers when they find it. Maybe he contemplated some scenarios in that regard. But again, to attach any real evil or bad to it, one would be stretching it, etc. All the food he put in their bags in their first trip so that they'd have enough food to get home on. That was unsolicited. So there could be sub-motives obviously involved with this, but we want to get down to the nitty-gritty here, what he's trying to do here in the whole scenario, and that is, continuing point 27, the primary intent here must be understood in the context of pulling the fast one over his brothers per verse 2. All that he does now is tied into now trying to bring his plan to fruition and to upset his brothers to a maximum degree. So 28, and only in the context then of verse 3 can we shed light as to the maneuvering behind the command to fill up the bags to the brim as much as they can lift, barely lift, etc. As soon as it was light, in verse 3 we saw the men were sent away, they with their donkeys. Habokar, or light of morning, wow, Haish, Shalak, him, wow, Kamor. So I alluded to this earlier. The 29, the Hebrew verb Shalak, or sent away, is the translation, is in the passive Niphal form in the Hebrew, meaning they were rousted out of bed and hustled out of town by some of Joseph's staff. They were sent away. They were prodded in leaving, would be a way you could look at it. So 30, at the crack of dawn, with their minds obviously in a fog from drunkenness, they're not going to be their sharpest after an afternoon of drinking and getting drunk. At the crack of dawn, with their minds in a fog from drunkenness, they are here forced in to load up their cargo bags on their donkeys and skedaddle. Didn't even have time to really sleep it off, per se. 31, now we see why Joseph loaded their sacks to the brim so they could barely lift them. They're in this mental state, this mental condition, physical condition even, to a certain degree. 32, the weight of the cargo would be challenged enough in loading. And under the rushing of leaving, who's going to think to check them for anything of the bags, for anything other than grain? Hangover, at the best, foggy, hazy, kind of drained physically from the partying. And the first thing they got to do is they're rousted out of bed, waking out of probably a fairly deep sleep. They are told they got to get up and they got to get out. They got to load their bags. The first thing they got to do is go in there and pick up something almost too heavy to lift, but they can still do it. And obviously, with all this going on, they're going to be preoccupied simply just trying to function, let alone trying to think out any complex thoughts that may be associated otherwise. So the weight of the cargo would be challenged enough, point 32, in loading, and under the rushing of leaving, who's going to check think to check them for anything other than grain? 33, under different conditions, to check their bags to see if, again, their money was returned might be expected and would jeopardize the whole plan. They woke up, normal day. Well, last time we had money in here. Let's see if there's money still this time before they left. Leave at their leisure, more or less, you know. But no, this is rush, rush. Get up. Pick up that bag. Get it on the donkey. Get the hell out of here. You know. So, 34, the situation as a whole. Hungover, heavy cargo, and immediate departure. Renders them not so inclined. And in this way, they are ushered out of town unsuspecting once again. So so there you can see at least the potential underlying motivation for Joseph to get drunk with his brothers. He has it all planned out in his mind. He don't care if he gets hoop-faced or not. But his brothers, he wants them in this condition. This is because he's got to hide a particular article in their bags, and he doesn't want them looking in their bags before the time is right. So 35, addressing the returning of silver, not much is said apart from the fact that we know that their money was returned again in this regards. So 35, the purpose now for returning the silver on this occasion is to further intimidate and build suspense when finally they do check their bags, with Benjamin's being the last check, as we will get into in verse 12. The steward will search their bags once again in chronological sequence to their birth. Nothing said about the silver, but obviously it's there. He's going to open up the bags, they're going to see the silver. And one brother after another, they're claiming they hadn't even had an opportunity. How in the world, how in hell can they accumulate silver, go from the house, steal it in the situation, conditions of which they were there? And all of a sudden they see the silver start popping up in their bags, one after another. You can just see the apprehension starting to build up. And it crescendos. And then you have the climax. You get to the youngest guy, the youngest brother, Benjamin, and bingo, oh, look, a silver cup. You're busted. So that is just to add to, if you will, the drama, the suspense. 36, the silver will further make them look the dupes, to be humiliated when they claim innocence as to take any silver or gold from the ruler's house. That, as I mentioned just previously in verse 8, how then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Well, we don't have any of that stuff on us. And all of a sudden he starts going, what? There it is again, unexplained. He really does a job on his brothers in this deal. Probably, hopefully, something they could all look back and laugh at later on. So 38. Now, timing in this situation was everything to carry this off. To make this happen, timing obviously is important. So 39, Joseph's plan could not allow time for his brothers to regain clarity and otherwise stop to reevaluate all that has gone on. He wasn't have time to be thinking, conversing about with one another. Probably didn't feel like talking to one another immediately, at least. 40, so just as they had gone out of the city and were not far off, Joseph gives his house steward further orders. He, the steward, was to prepare himself for departure. That's the emphasis of our verb to arise or get up, kum. And, quote, follow the men. And when you overtake them, confront them with a charge of theft. Radaf Akare Haish Wa Nasag. So essentially, Joseph deputizes the steward to go out and serve a warrant, if you will. Accuse them of being thieves. 42. Now the steward's accusation here was to be such that it simply implied the brothers would know what he was talking about without specifically mentioning the silver cup. He does it in such a way you know what I'm talking about. I don't have to tell you what it is. Type and approach. 43. The opening salvo bombardment of accusation was, quote, why have you repaid evil for good? Lama shalom shalem ra'a takath tob. Forty-four. This obviously would immediately put them on the defensive, inciting apprehension. Well, that would just take them back immediately. 45. It was designed to amplify their supposed guilt at not only stealing, but stealing from a host that has just previously extended gracious hospitality, showing benevolence. Obviously, it's wrong to steal no matter the situation. It's a sin. It's one thing to, break and enter and steal from people you don't know or something of that nature. It's another thing to go in and people that have opened their doors, helped, and other things have shown compassion, sympathy, other aspects of affection, if you will, and help, and go in and then turn around and rob them blind. That is a lower form of evil. That's low life kind of stuff there. And here, the vizier of Egypt has just entertained him with an afternoon of great food and revelry. And this in spite of what the vizier, the authority, had initially accused them of on their first trip. And here, how could they turn around and then take advantage of this person in such a situation? So it's designed to really crank up the charge in and of itself as being not only just a crime in and of itself, but a crime against humanity, so to speak, in doing evil towards good. We're never to return evil for good. We're never to return evil for evil. The Bible teaches us to teach return good for evil. That's divine good. That's application of Bible doctrine. Obviously, all that is to be taken in within the context of the rest of the Scripture. In other words, we're not to, as a nation, feed our enemies, empower them, provide them military assistance and monies to build up their military when they're an aggressive nation and a danger to one's own society. What idiots rule in that country? Well, there's been a few of them around here. You're to apply divine good. Obviously, if opportunity is given, maybe a country such as that that has shown aggression, hostility, has a natural catastrophe, maybe to provide them some assistance in trying to help them, their citizens, that might be appropriate. Maybe that will get them to rethink the relationship, things of that nature. But for us as individuals and as believers, people do us harm, things of this nature. We are to leave room for God to take revenge on our part. Doesn't mean that you cannot legally defend yourself, and deal with legal issues and matters otherwise. But we're not to take revenge. We're not to engage in revenge tactics. That's what Joseph is doing here. And we are to always apply Bible doctrine. Jesus said, love your enemies. You've been taught to love your friends and hate your enemies. No, love your enemies. That means when opportunity arises, apply Bible doctrine towards those who are otherwise antagonistic or hostile to doctrine. And obviously, you tend to be the target because you're the one that burns their ears with it. Let's see. So, the accusation is designed just to kick their feet out from underneath them in regards to just describing them, characterizing them as being real lowlifes to engage in some petty thing like this. It's just saying, how petty is this? Yeah. So 46, to add now to the seriousness of charge, the steward was to further inform them that the theft was not of just some common item, but, quote, is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, in which he indeed uses for divination? Ahalo, Zeth, Asher, Shethah, Adon, Bet, Wahu, Nakash. Nakash, it should be. Bet. Nakash, as we saw, the literal translation, divining, he will divine, is the literal translation. Divining, he will prophesy, or however you may want to express that. 47, this part of the charge here, so this is a special item, a special religious item that they've absconded, supposedly. So 47, now this part of the charge reveals that the silver cup in view was the very cup Joseph was drinking from during the feast. The question itself is rhetorical, recognizing they would know the cup now that is being referred to as it is one that Joseph was drinking in front of them as they were all facing each other during the feast, enjoying their wine or whatever they were drinking. This would then, obviously, this gives them insight. This would enlighten the brothers to exactly what they were being accused of stealing, as they would have visually seen the cup during the party. Now Joseph further embellishes the use of the cup in his orders here as one not only of ownership but for religious practice, that is, divination. 50, the literal Hebrew, nakash, divining, he will divine, divination is how it's translated. Utilizes dual verbs, being infinitival, infinitive, and imperfect, in form, to emphasize the vessel had been sanctified, for ongoing and future use. Continuous, past and present, and into the future, and will divine. So there's your twofold sense that's being brought out of this. 51, in other words, it was to be perceived as irreplaceable. This was a really special silver cup. This one has been set apart. Sanctify, that's what sanctify means, to be set apart for a purpose. When a believer is sanctified towards God, then they are set apart for God's purpose. Here, the cup has been set apart for purpose, for the vizier to work his magic, to divine, to see things, recognize things, obscure to the normal individual. And this cup was irreplaceable, looking at the fact that it was made for that purpose, maybe whatever rituals would be attached to it, and indeed, that was a special utensil and vessel in the house of Joseph, or the vizier. So we can't replace it. We've got to have it back. 52, the verb means to divine by observing and fortune-telling. We've seen this aspect of pagan practice already, at least a reference to the practice in terms of what it means, but being able to observe or fortune tell, see the future without, or that which may be otherwise obscure, generally speaking, to people in their thinking. 53, it was part of the occult practices that were common in both Egypt and Canaan, part of the pagan practices. You've got prophets in every religion. Unfortunately, most of them are false. We've got prophets in the religions of science today. They'll sit there and they'll tell you this is what's going to happen. This is the way it's going to end up. The earth is going to, all the ice caps and all the icebergs are all going to melt. Everybody's going to flood out. We're going to lose half the country. You're worried just about half? You're worried about the coastal lines? Wake up, people. Or whatever. We'll eradicate disease with this cure. Oh, yeah. I guess God must be at the mercy of man's extreme intelligence in the science, the field of science. This, again, to dismiss God in the equation of looking at things in this world. That's what the world does. They dismiss God altogether. It's up to us. We're the ones bringing about the disaster. We're the ones that can control viruses. Of course, people with little common sense in their mind recognize the absurdity in regards to comments like this. But, anyway. So, divining. Scientists divine a global warming is going to bring about catastrophe in the world. 54, and we dealt with this earlier to a certain degree, but as a reminder, review. One method was to put water in a cup and sprinkle gold or silver particles in the water, and then try to interpret the future by the pattern in which the particles settled. They would have some key, some code. manufactured. This is what it's supposed to mean. Obviously, you can't dismiss demon influence and possessions in regards to things like this. Another was to pour oil in the water. It's called oleomancy. And interpret the patterns formed in that regards as the oil was spread out on the water. Spread out over the ocean in Alaska. Oh, I divine the Valdez has been by. Okay. Oleomancy. 56, another was to pour water on oil, just the reverse. It's called hydromancy, and observe the patterns. 57, the practice was forbidden under the law. We're not to go that way based on the Mosaic law, Leviticus 19:26. You shall not eat anything with the blood. In other words, they were to abstain from drinking blood in animals that they would use for food, nor practice divination or soothsaying. Soothsaying might be the astrology approach to life. The stars are aligned. Now we can look at the Bible as it depicts certain constellations and alignments and see the doctrine that otherwise is provided in that respect. But to get up and find out you know, your life, what's going to be like today, well, you're Leo or you're Scorpio or whatever, that's just nothing more than paganism. That's soothsaying if you rely on that kind of stuff. Not that people aren't curious, I'm not talking about that. People live by it like that. Mrs. Reagan, she was like that. And you know, everybody, oh, how great President Reagan was. What's going on behind the scene? See, people are so shallow sometimes when they look and observe, and they don't really investigate and see things that are going on. But anyway, it's all part of the master plan, man. Deuteronomy 18:10. When the Jews were warned, the conquest, when they went in to occupy the land that God was going to give them, yes, God authors certain peoples to conquer other peoples, creating nations. God uses nations as whipping posts against other the evil of other nations. It was God's purpose for the Jews to occupy the land known as Israel in Egypt, in the Middle East. What they have occupied to date in history is only a fraction of the entirety of the real estate that they were supposed to enjoy, and that is because they have never reached the pinnacle of spirituality, if you will, positive volition, as we might view it in regards to them as a people. This will occur under the rule of Jesus when he returns the second advent. They're screaming about their borders here and there with the other neighbors. Look out. They're going to widen that one of these days, and nobody's going to do anything about it. But anyway, in their conquering land, obviously, as Moses had warned the people, how you act experientially in regards to being a society and as being a peoples and being a nation, in terms of obedience to God and His Word versus disobedience, being reversionist, etc., will determine how God blesses you in the land. And so when they went in, they were to completely obliterate and do away with and reject anything other than the truth of Bible doctrine under their dispensational guidelines in acceptance or representation in regards to them as a people. And to stay away from false teaching, false religions. Verse 9, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the detestable things of those nations. There should not be found among you, verse 10, anyone who makes a son or his daughter pass through the fire. That's just how evil some of these pagan religions are. Some pagan religions call for human sacrifice. Antichrist's agenda calls for human sacrifice. And yes, we are in the pilot period that's advancing us towards that agenda. And the great merchants are guilty in regards to much of it. Not to dismiss the roles of governments. Usually all this was for the phallic practice, for the sexual aspects of life. This is why people go this. The perversions of the mind under the STA is quite despicable when it's left unbridled and not dealt with and overruled. You know, not make a son or his daughter pass through the fire, or one who uses divination, who practices witchcraft. Oh, that's just a cool thing nowadays, isn't it? Well, I'm a white witch. Well, you're a racist then. But anyway. Or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer. See. So the law prohibited this kind of practice. So 58, as we saw earlier, as when we dealt with this term, Nakash, it was used of Laban foreseeing that he was blessed by association with Jacob back in Genesis 30, verse 27. I see that the Lord has blessed me because of you. That's what he said. And the implication was to underline Laban's reversionism in his approach to things. 59. Now Joseph, having married into an Egyptian priestly family, would be quite aware of any particulars as to this pagan practice. He would be quite familiar with it. It says even one today, maybe a just on dog, might be quite familiar with other religious organizations and their practice. But he, one of the gifts was given to him, his wife came out of a priest's family. She was a priest's daughter. We conclude that she ultimately was positive. As many people as we've seen have appeared to reflect positive volition associated with Joseph. And one of the reasons why he's there in the Jews, because God knows where pockets of positive volition exist in nations at any given point in time in history. So 60 here, Joseph uses it to further elevate the trepidation he wants to impose upon the brothers. This man is mystical. He's powerful in the spiritual, in the spirit world. See, that's the idea. Already he's appealed to Yahweh. See, don't lose out, hopefully, don't lose out on the ironies of the scenes as they have played out. He's appealed to Yahweh. The steward has appealed to Yahweh in regards to sound doctrine. Well, the brothers hadn't had a word to say. No comebacks. No attempts at engaging in any doctrinal discourse otherwise regarding things. Okay, fine. Divination. Pagan practice. Got anything to say about that? I'm trying to add a little color to you, for you, in regards to why Joseph implements this thing. So, 61, he again plays on their mysticism. He discerns they adhere. He sees it in them. Whatever growth they may have had, obviously they still have some large gaps spiritually, as we've seen in regards to their life. 62, they remain mute as to the doctrinal assertions thrown at them to see how they react to a claim of paganist practice. This would have been an opportunity to say, well, that's wrong. He shouldn't be using that silver cup for divination. You know, that's evil. Why would we, and we think, why would we steal that cup? We don't want to have anything to do with evil. But again, they remain mute. Joseph obviously didn't engage in occult practice. Some interpreters want to say, "Oh, see, he was steeped in this stuff." No, he was not. That is taking everything out of context, and not recognizing that Joseph is claiming this to continue to advance his scheme and the trepidation, if you will, the apprehension of his brothers, and stir these things up. So Joseph obviously didn't engage in occult practice, point 63, but he uses the claim to make himself look as if he was prophetic or a sorcerer, a wizard. Wizard of Egypt. 64. This would work as leverage to incite further fear, as they might recall how he picked Simeon to be bound on the first trip. Remember back on that. They couldn't come to agreement which brother is going to be left behind as they all return home on the first trip. So he just walks in there and he picked for him. He picked Simeon, who would have been the brother that instigated the hatred towards him by obvious characterization earlier in his kidnapping. And he was aware of that. See. So how ironic is that? See, is that they would think. Being mystic, even more so. Then, continue here, their seating arrangement yesterday at the feast, as they all looked at each other in shock. How did this happen? And even add to any mysticism of the silver that keeps appearing in their cargo. So you can see here how Joseph really plays these guys, man. He takes advantage of their spiritual weaknesses to employ his own STA weakness. And that's the way the STA operates. It loves to take advantage of other STAs. That's why the advertisement field is the way it is. Feeding off people's greed, desire to pursue the details in life and things of this nature, sex sales, all these things. Appeal to the STA. See. Utilize it and leverage it to your advantage. That's the way the world operates. We're not to operate that way. We are to let Bible doctrine leverage us and let God provide for us and promote us and things of this nature, and not take advantage of people's otherwise. So 65, Joseph plays his brother's SEA religious weaknesses for advantage and to pull off this vindictive deed. So 66, with the instructions clear, the steward will set off to perform his task. Father, again, thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, to continue to lighten these things in Jesus' name. Amen.